A couch potato warning is in effect as DirecTV transforms Thanksgiving into Streamsgiving. DirecTV's got free TV nationwide. With a heavy front of 60-plus live channels and a steady stream of streaming apps, conditions are perfect for nonstop entertainment. So hunker down on the couch and sign up for your free trial of My Entertainment from DirecTV. I'm going to watch some free TV.
Start streaming My Entertainment from DirecTV now at streamsgiving.com. My free is free. Paid services. 5-day free trial, then auto-renews monthly. Cancel anytime. Temporary credit hold may apply. Restrictions apply. See streamsgiving.com for details. AI produced.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
This is Hidden Killers Year in Review. A look back at the biggest stories of 2025. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
The man, Brian Koberger's defense is counting to prove that he wasn't at the scene of the Idaho student murders. He's a retired cop whose phone mapping analysis has faced scrutiny in previous cases, where a Colorado judge raised concerns about its reliability. The individual, Cy Ray, is a key part of the alibi that suggests Koberger was driving in rural Washington and Idaho, not brutally murdering four students in their home. So let's break this down. Before we talk about what he's claiming in the Koberger case, we need to talk about the concerns that have been raised about the prior work of his. Now, this is in no way trying to say that he's not good at his job or that he doesn't have credentials. He does. He certainly does. But some of those things have been questioned by a judge in court before. So we're going to talk about just some of those facts. This is very likely a good guy trying to do what he believes in with the technology that he also believes in. But what needs to be done, as a judge had ruled in a previous case, there needs to be a little more insight and openness about how this technology works, about the oversight of it, its credibility and the accountability that it faces in scrutiny. So let's look into that just a little bit in these concerns about his prior work, because it's not subtle. It's not a matter of interpretation. It's a court document, a black and white document where a judge lays out in no uncertain terms that Cy Ray's analysis in a previous case, a tool that he developed, couldn't be presented to a jury. Not because the jury wouldn't understand it, but because the foundation of it is what the judge was questioning. It was in 2023 that Ray was brought in to testify in a Colorado criminal case. The same sort of thing, somewhat. Location data, cell tower mapping, a question of where someone was during a crime. Important parts to a case. And that is Ray's area of expertise. His software called Trax was supposed to visualize this data in a compelling way. And that's great. Juries, people in general, like to see things mapped out. It's far more compelling to see how things look on a map with specific points versus just a sheet of numbers and different points of where something may or may not be. Cell tower hits, triangulation, pings, turned into a clean, easy-to-read map. Could be a great thing for juries. Be a great thing for anyone just trying to do research and understand the location of someone and where they were and when. It looks sharp, slick, even the kind of tool you could imagine swaying a jury if you didn't dig too deep. But as one should, the judge did dig deep. And what he found, and this is the judge's opinion, wasn't just a few technical hiccups. It was concerns about its scientific grounding. There was no known error rate for the software, kind of important in something like this. No published methodology, and no peer reviews. It was, to borrow a court's phrase, visually compelling, and it was. But beneath the surface, kind of a liability. The kind that, if presented to a jury, might look like hard science, but was actually something that needed maybe a bit of work. If a judge is saying that it can't be admitted into court, and with those factors that the judge had talked about there, that's understandable. It didn't meet the standards for expert testimony. That's why judges vet expert witnesses. And look, one judge could say that this is fine to use. Another could have a completely different opinion, but that is the opinion of one judge of the software that he was using at that time. Now, it's important to note here, we don't know for sure, at least as of this moment, if that same software is what he would want to use in this case. There's been a lot of things we've been told that says it's not. So take that into account. I don't know what he plans on using, but you have to understand that this was the technology that was attempted in that case to be introduced into a court of law to determine where someone was, determine eventually if they're going to be free or not. It's kind of a big deal. Cyray himself, he's someone who takes a stand as an expert witness. Their credibility is important. It's not just about what they say, it's who they are, how they know what they know, and how transparently they can show their work. But according to the court, Ray's description of his qualifications in that case was also a bit of a point of contention, according to the court. And what might be described as a significant difference in how Ray characterized his credentials, Ray told the court he was more of an engineer than an engineer. That's a quote. The problem is, he's not an engineer. Not by degree, not by license, not even by broad definition. In fact, his academic background doesn't include any direct related things with engineering. The court noted this difference, particularly in the context of expert testimony. And just like that, the individual presenting the analysis faced questions about his expertise. Again, this is what judges do. They are there to make sure the experts that one brings in are truly experts in the specific area they're being brought into. It is not unheard of for a judge to go, this person has expertise, but it's not strong enough in the area that they're trying to present the information for this case in. That is very common and normal. Because sometimes when you're backed into a corner, some experts just ain't going to help you. And there may be some that go, you know what? I think those ones are wrong. I think what I have is more accurate and better. And people are free to do that. People are free to say that. A judge at the end of the day is the one who has to decide if what they're saying is credible, if it could be an alternative way of looking at the data. So the court ended up in that case excluding the evidence. Full stop. And is noteworthy in this case. Experts don't usually get their evidence barred unless there are substantial concerns about the methodology. And as we outlined earlier, the judge had some concerns. But Ray's software and testimony didn't just raise questions. They raised significant scrutiny in that case. So why does all of this matter here in the Koberger case? Because this is the same individual that is now positioned as the defense's primary expert witness. The person they're relying on to convince a jury that Brian Koberger never went near the crime scene the night of the murders. That his phone never pinged a tower on the route towards the victim's home. That he was allegedly out driving under the stars, according to Ann Taylor, on a very foggy, cloudy night where you can't see the stars. And some sort of midnight soul search where four people were stabbed to death just miles away. He just happened to be somewhat in the area. And Cy is the guy that the Koberger folks are saying, prove it. Prove to them that what we're telling you is true, that he was not close to this crime scene. Because over here, there's a lot of evidence that's saying he was. We need something solid that says he wasn't. They're not saying to make something up. They're looking for somebody that can have some sort of factual data that can be presented that may disagree with some of the other pieces of evidence, or at the very least, or very best, depending how you look at it, provide reasonable doubt. Because that is the bar. Reasonable doubt. Is there a level of reasonable doubt in this case that Brian Koberger might not be the person? That maybe there's a piece of data out there that shows or proves that he couldn't have been the person. That's what they're trying to get Ray to produce. And he, being on this case as of right now, judge still has to decide as of this recording if he'll let this evidence in. He believes he, as far as we can tell, has the data, has the facts to do just that. Does he? Not saying he doesn't. That's for a court to eventually decide. To be fair, Ray hasn't said he's using tracks in this case, the software that he used in that other one that the judge said, don't think so. Could be something completely different. We just do not know at this time. But again, context, history, credentials, all that important. It's part of the resume. The defense may argue that whatever issues existed in Colorado don't apply here. And they might not. Maybe he's sticking to raw data. Maybe he's changed his methods. But here's the problem. His testimony still hinges on some kind of analysis of the data. Same type of data that his software was built to perform that the judge said, we're not going to admit this. So the judge says in one case, we don't think this is admissible. He may disagree. He may have the opinion that, look, maybe you don't understand this judge correctly, and I do. Maybe I don't have the peer reviews. Maybe I don't have this. Maybe I don't have that. But the data's solid. And that can be the case. No, that's, again, up for the judges to decide. You don't separate the man from his methods just because you don't say the software name out loud. But there's trial and error, you know? As you develop things, as you learn things, you know, you want to make sure they're ready to go to market before they actually do. Sometimes you get a wake-up call once you get to market, as seemingly happened there in Colorado, with the judge saying, not ready for prime time yet. Not to say the technology couldn't have improved or that he doesn't have a different way of going about this. So there's a core issue that is remaining here. The maps, how he interprets the cellular data, how he turns it into movement patterns and locations. And the moment he puts that in front of a jury, it carries weight. Until, of course, someone reminds the court that a judge previously raised concerns about the reliability of the underlying methodology, which, again, that may or may not be admitted into court. That could very easily be something where the judge says, nope, that has nothing to do with this case. It's not even the same software. Who knows? There's ways where that would not necessarily be admitted, but it's something that is dangling out there. And if you're in the Brian Koberger camp, you really need something solid at this point. You can't go out there on a whim. You can't go out there on an if. You can't go out there, even if you have somebody that you believe and they believe has data that shows something different than what others are interpreting. If that's going to get holes punched through it and the jury is going to look at that as unreliable, you probably just should not present it at all. Unless you have no other options, then it's kind of a Hail Mary. But time will tell once we get into the case and once we get into court to see just how much evidence each side truly has on the other. Right now, a lot of it's stacking up against Koberger. Ray has already testified once in May of 2024 in a pretrial hearing, not about tracks, but about the data, or more specifically, the missing data, according to him. 2 to 3% of the cell phone records, he says, in the case weren't turned over by the prosecution. That might not sound like much, but he did emphasize that the gaps appeared in some of the most critical areas. Places where, if the data existed, it might show Koberger's phone moving towards or away from the crime scene, according to him. And that's important. But so is the framing, because what Ray is essentially arguing is that what's missing is more valuable than what's there. Okay? But keep in mind, Ray is not here to argue the whole case. He's just there to argue the cell data itself. That's it. He's not there to prove anything else. This is his area, according to him, and that's what he is providing to the court, according to his analysis. There's nothing wrong with that. And you can disagree with what the opposite side is claiming, but you have to back up your work. The absence of certain records does benefit the defense, of course, but it also leads to interpretation and hangs on that. It leans on it heavily. The very thing a judge questioned in the earlier ruling. In that Colorado case, the court noted that Ray's analysis involved assumptions, not just technical gaps, but logical leaps, like inferring direction of travel or specific location without solid backup, according to the judge. That kind of interpretation gets even riskier when you're basing it on incomplete data, like in the Koberger case. So, you're following along. An individual whose analysis faced scrutiny is now, by a lot of consensus, the centerpiece of the defense. That depends entirely on his ability to read, interpret, and argue the meaning of phone records that may or may not be complete. To help Koberger, you would be a witness for them. That's the current landscape. It's not a minor detail. It is a foundation shaker. Let's be clear, Koberger, he deserves a defense, without a doubt. The prosecution and the presumption of innocence isn't just a formality, it is the law. And reasonable doubt is the standard. But when a defense hinges on expert analysis that analysts needs to be sound, Cy Ray's track record there, or at least that mark from that one judge, it will raise questions about the reliability of the methods employed. But again, we have to understand that we do not know what is he using. He could have taken that away, I don't know, and said, okay, yeah, some flaws here. Let's button this up. Let's make this better. Let's do something completely different. We don't know the answer to that question. But I do believe he's coming into this on the right foot, believing that his methods are more accurate. There's no other reason why you would do that. It's just, does it stand up against everything else? And that's where this really hits, because the cell phone data, when used properly, can be powerful. It can place someone at the scene or away from it with a high degree of confidence. But when the person doing the placing has a history of analysis that has been questioned, that's, again, not evidence that if you're the defendant, want to put out there. And in this case, it's a situation with high stakes. They don't leave room for untested maps or theories built on missing information. The jury's going to have to weigh that carefully, because a person's life is in the balance here. But comes up next in this whole story is the other side of the coin, because while Ray might be the individual leading the defense's digital charge, it wasn't always this way. This isn't some career-long advocate for the accused. Most of his career, Cy Ray was on the other side, helping prosecutors lock up people using different technology. That transition tells its own story. And it's where we go next, because Cy Ray says Brian Koberger's phone never took the Moscow Pullman Highway the night four University of Idaho students were killed. Not once. That's the core of the analysis. It's not hedging. His interpretation of the phone records is simple. This is how I would interpret it. Koberger didn't drive east from Pullman towards Moscow that night. That's what he's saying his data is saying, basically. He didn't head down that road, that key stretch of road that connects his apartment to the crime scene. He was, according to Ray, off somewhere else entirely. And if that's true, it's a powerful alibi. But here's the problem. It doesn't just tweak the state's timeline, it challenged the whole thing, because literally every other data point in this case says something different, something louder, something far more direct, and if we're being honest, something far harder to ignore. Let's start with the surveillance footage. And I know here's where a lot of people break off, and this is where you need critical thinking, able to look at both sides of the coin. You can't just dismiss the other side as, this is all unreliable. Everything's being planted. There's not a lot of evidence of that in this case. I'm sorry. If you want to look at a case that has a lot of issues with corruption, go look at Delphi. Go look at Sandra Birchmore. Potentially go look at Karen Reed. I don't see it here. I just don't. So, there's a lot of data, a lot of other places, a lot of moving parts that don't necessarily relate to one another other than Brian Koberger. So if you're going to go down the conspiracy route, that's, again, a lot of people in a lot of different places that don't know each other, all conspiring to frame Brian Koberger, of all people. How that logic adds up in anyone's mind, I don't know. I would love to hear it in the comments if you got some logic about it, and you can express yourself in a way that's not simply, this is all a lie, look at this bombshell. That's not evidence saying bombshell and look at this lie. Evidence is presenting your opinion in a clear and concise way, and we can talk about it. So I do want to hear it if you have it. Or if you think that Cy is probably not the best option for Koberger being an expert witness, tell me that. I mean, whatever you think in the comment section on our YouTube channel or anywhere else you're listening to this on a podcast, be sure to subscribe. And be sure, if you're not yet, check out that that YouTube channel, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, and press subscribe there. So in the early morning hours of November 13th, multiple surveillance cameras across different locations captured a white Hyundai Elantra moving along that very same Moscow Pullman Highway. The make and model are a match for the car Koberger drove. People will argue and say, well, they first said it was this year, but then it turned out to be that year. Yeah, they look pretty damn similar, and we're talking about security cameras. So they were right on the model and the make. Year was just slightly off. That's not a crazy difference in the vehicle they thought he was driving. We're also not talking about a single grainy frame anymore either. These were time-stamped clips showing a white vehicle consistent with Koberger's Elantra heading towards Moscow before the murders and then leaving the area shortly after. Of course, cars are not fingerprints, sure, but we're not in the realm of that could be anyone's sedan. Investigators tracked this vehicle on multiple cameras. They traced it circling the neighborhood, making passes by the victim's house, pausing, returning. This wasn't just a drive-by. This was repeated movements in the area where the murders happened within the time frame when they happened. That same make and model, that same pattern over and over. You can't deny that. One could say, well, it was another Hyundai Elantra. There's a lot of them on the road. And I'm sure that's what will be argued. Maybe it was. But then let's add some other pieces to the equation. So you look at just one over here, just one over there, and you base your whole case on just one piece, you're not going to get a good understanding, or you're not going to make a good decision or good assumption on where you think this is going. You got to base it on the whole big picture. And that's what we're trying to do here. While that vehicle was caught on camera, Koberger's phone went silent. Yeah, that's a part not disputed. Between roughly 2:47 a.m. and 4:48 a.m., the precise window when the killings occurred, Koberger's phone was off the grid. No signals, no pings, nothing. For just over 2 hours, the device went dark. We're not saying turning your phone off is a crime. People, of course, do it all the time. But when it lines up perfectly with a quadruple homicide that you're being accused of committing, you'd better have one hell of a reason. And I was out driving under the stars doesn't exactly explain why you needed to go dark for 121 minutes in the dead of night on a night that they had no stars. And when the phone does reappear, it's pinging near the same area where the murders took place, just after 4:45 a.m. The phone reconnects to a cell tower in Moscow, right there, close to the crime scene, not in some distant hiking spot or some other highway way far away. Not halfway across the country. It's back where the crimes were taking place. It's a rough sequence for a defense that wants you to believe their client was nowhere near the murders, but that's not the only brick in this wall. There's also the DNA on the button strap of a leather knife sheath found under one of the victims. Investigators recovered a sample that of DNA that on that sheath believed to belong to the murder weapon. They were connected. The DNA on that sheath came back as a familial match to Brian Koberger. You may remember later a direct match was made from a trash piece that was pulled at his family's home in Pennsylvania. That sheath wasn't touched by a dozen people. It was handled by one, and the genetic link ties back to him. So it's not circumstantial. It is physical, it's specific, and it is hard one to spin. So at this point, we've got a vehicle that looks like his, caught on camera near the crime scene, and we've got his phone going dark just before the murders and reconnecting right after, right back in the area. And we've got DNA on a murder-related object that points to him. And yet Cy Ray says the cell data clears him. Okay. Let's be really clear about what that means. Ray is not suggesting a minor discrepancy. He isn't saying, hey, I think the phone took a slightly different route. He's saying the entire prosecution timeline would be wrong according to his data. Again, it's not for him to prove all the other data. He's just saying the data that he has, that he is believing to be accurate, would contradict all of that. He's not there to argue the other points. He's just there to show his data. That's what he's hired for. It's what he does. The Koberger wasn't on the road. Their experts say he was on. That the phone never went east, that it never got close enough to matter. According to Ray, if the phone didn't take that route, then the car seen on the video couldn't have been his. And if that's not his car, then everything else starts to unravel. At least that's what the data would prove if it is factual. I'm saying he's personally saying that. I guess I'm saying if the data he has is reliable, then everything else certainly would have to be looked at. It's an interesting one. Certainly puts possibly some reasonable doubt into the mix. So certainly the defense's strategy. Pull out one thread and hope the whole case unravels underneath it. Could it? Anything is possible. That strategy does only work if the thread you're pulling is stronger than the rest. In this case, it's one man's interpretation of a small slice of phone records going up against a mountain of corroborating data. Even the FBI's own experts, people who do this kind of analysis professionally, full-time, reviewed the same records and concluded that the movements matched the prosecution's timeline. The phone's pings, when charted, do show movement that aligns with the vehicle on camera. The phone being off during the murders, that doesn't refute the timeline. It strengthens the theory that someone was deliberately trying to avoid being tracked. And when the phone comes back online, its location does suggest a loop down towards the scene, then going away. In other words, the government's analysis builds a cohesive picture. Ray's interpretation builds a contradiction, one that asks the court to ignore multiple streams of independent evidence because one individual says the phone logs don't fit the route. Does that mean Ray is intentionally misrepresenting information? Not at all. He likely seriously believes his read on the data is more accurate. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. Expert witnesses challenge government data all the time. That is what they do. But what he's proposing, if his data is correct, would raise a lot of concerns. It asks for a complete substitution. Take all the existing evidence and toss it out the window. Replace it with this theory, which directly contradicts the video, timing, forensic evidence. Koberger buying the knife, Koberger buying the mask, and all the other weird, creepy stuff that we have mixed in here. Papa Rogers' picture that we, of course, can't confirm it's him, but certainly looked like Koberger in the picture, or artistic interpretation of him, and someone who is presenting information online, seemingly taunting everyone with facts that only the killer would know, and pushing back on anything that may point to him, like, oh, Hyundai Elantra, that's a red herring. So there's that. There's a lot of things that, if size data is correct, would contradict. Could that data be stronger than all of it? Yes, it very possibly could be. But is it? It's a bold move. And to be fair, bold moves sometimes work, especially in courtrooms. Jurors are human. They can be swayed by reasonable doubt. They can latch onto a single piece that strays from the rest of the story. And if presented well, it can make a big difference. It also means that the defense is walking a high wire here. No safety net. If Ray's testimony falters, if the judge limits it, or if the jury sees through it, or if it's not allowed in at all, well, that entire alibi takes a hit. And as of now, there's not much left to lean on. The truth is, Ray might be one of the few voices arguing this interpretation. But he's not just up against the prosecution. He's up against video cameras, DNA, digital trail gaps, and crime scenes that tell a story that you can't rewrite with cell tower coordinates. And that's where things start to feel like it might end up turning into a collision. Because, yes, Cy Ray wasn't always the individual poking holes in the state's case. For most of his career, he was the state's case, working side by side with law enforcement, helping prosecutors put people away, using different technology and data to do that. And again, nothing wrong with that. He's gone from one side to another. Again, nothing wrong with that. Expert witnesses can be called for prosecution, for defense. Just depends. But what does it all mean at the end of the day? What will his data tell us about the case against Koberger? He is a former law enforcement officer turned data consultant. He understands the case's digital evidence better than a lot of people. But he's basically claiming by presenting his side that he understands it better than the entire investigative team that was built
the FBI's CAST team, surveillance analysis, forensic techs, even cell site engineers, all of them. If you're to believe the interpretation of data that's being presented by him, they all got it wrong, and he's the one who got it right. That's what you'd have to believe. I'm not telling you you have to believe one side or the other, but that is what you would have to believe. It's a tough pitch in any courtroom, but in a case like this where the pressure is sky high and the public scrutiny is constant and the facts are under a microscope, it's a big one. Because the moment Cy Ray takes a stand, if he does, his testimony will be measured against more than just his own words. It'll be stacked against the total weight of the state's case, and that's not a small hill to climb. That is Everest. The FBI Cellular Analysis Survey Team, CAST for short, is a specialized unit. Their job is to map out where cell phones have been using tower data, call records, and location analysis. There aren't tech hobbyists or contractors. They're full-time federal experts. I'm not saying that Cy is a hobbyist. I believe he takes his work very seriously. In the Koberger case, the prosecution relied on CAST to build a timeline that shows Koberger's phone moving around Moscow the night of the murders. They used standard industry tools backed by years of precedent. And when they laid out their findings, it wasn't just some theory, it was a detailed documented report based on data collected directly from Koberger's provider. Then that puts the data next to what their expert is saying, that those findings are severely flawed. He says the phone didn't go where CAST said it did. And that might sound like a solid defense angle until you remember, again, there's a history where a judge has raised concerns about the reliability of some of the methods that were used. Again, different case, may not be the same sort of analysis that's going on here, but it's a nick that you don't want a jury to necessarily hear about when you're trying to argue your case and have solid evidence on your side without any sort of blemishes. That's important. The prosecution's case isn't based on just that one kind of evidence, obviously. It's built like a bridge. We have met many, many records of surveillance footage, DNA, phone, car tracking, behavior patterns. Pulling, again, out one piece doesn't make it collapse. But that's what the defense is banking on. And reasonable doubt is a very powerful thing in a case like this. I'm sure Ray is acting in good faith. His role in this case isn't technical. It's to cast doubt. Go, hey, I think this information is not as accurate as mine. This happens all the time. But we're talking about the lives here of four young kids that were murdered. And you have a stack of evidence over here, including a different interpretation of the cell data. And you have over here just a piece, this one piece that says, well, that one piece up there is wrong. What about everything else up here? You know, sometimes you can get in there and pull the string out and the whole thing collapses. And sometimes you go over there to the Jenga. That's what I'm thinking of it as. The Jenga tower, and you pull one piece out and the whole case stands firm. So I guess we'll have to ask ourselves and find out, once this does make it to trial, if this theory makes it to trial, what kind of piece on the Jenga tower is this that's being pulled out? Is it one of those critical pieces that, you know, don't touch that one? Or comes right out. And the tower still stands. It's a bit of a wild card. One that the defense of Koberger may not have many other options to play. So you lay it down and you see what happens. What do you guys think? I've seen many comments saying, look into this. Look into this data. Look into this bombshell. So I have. And that's what I found. What have you found? And I don't mean like just a bunch of stray words. It's a lie. It's conspiracy. Bombshell. No, what contradicts us? It's a conversation. Because this guy is an expert witness, and I believe he can probably provide pretty decent testimony in a case. Just because one judge found his findings or his data in one to be inaccurate, that is one judge's finding. Like I said, another judge can interpret it completely differently. We have yet to see how this judge takes his data and his findings. And you have to stack all of it together. And even at the end of the day, his cell data is found to be more accurate than everything else. Is that enough to sway a jury? Is it enough to disprove the DNA and all the other pieces that are stacking up in this case? I don't know. When your life is on the line, I think you're going to take almost anything you got. And if that's the best card you have to play, then that might be the best card you have to play. Time will tell. Tell me what you think in the comments on YouTube. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're watching or listening to this. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, press subscribe there. We even have a premium option for you where you can get everything ad-free and in advance. So do check that out. If you're on YouTube, press subscribe, hit the bell. Let your friends know that we exist. Share the story. We appreciate the support. I look forward to hearing your response and your opinion on this part of the Brian Koberger case. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for watching.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
The most quietly devastating piece of evidence, potentially, in the case against Brian Koberger wasn't stained with blood. Didn't need a lab for DNA testing, and didn't even require much explanation at all. It was an ID card tucked away inside a glove, inside a box, sitting in a house nearly 2,500 miles from the actual murder scene itself. Remember this? Now, there's some speculation on it, and we're going to get to that because some, I'm sure, are screaming at me right now going, wait a second, it was... Okay, we're going to address all that. We're going to be going through all the other evidence in the case against Brian Koberger today that maybe you forgot about, because there was a lot that came in right off the bat, a lot on those records that showed what was taken from the homes, or his home, yeah, two homes. We got the one out there in Washington, and we have the one in Pennsylvania. We're going to go through all of it, and a lot of the pieces that are still sitting out on the ether, what they may mean now with the new discovery that we have and the new pieces that we've learned in this case. And we're going to analyze just how damning some of these pieces might be, if in fact they are what they appear to be. All right. Be sure to press subscribe right now, wherever you're downloading podcasts, or if you're watching us on YouTube, so you don't miss any of our coverage on this case. We thank you very much. And I want to encourage you right now in the comments, please leave me your thoughts. Even if you disagree with me, that's fine. That's fine. If you agree, great. Just give me your thoughts. All I want is your opinion. It's a dialogue that we have going on here, not an argument. So the ID wasn't discovered in the early frenzy of the investigation. It wasn't mentioned in the first court filings that lit up every news feed in America. Instead, it showed up in a list, a dry, methodical inventory of items taken from Koberger's parents' home in Albrightsville, Pennsylvania, on December 30th of 2022. But it wasn't until March of the following year, when that search warrant return was unsealed, that everyone outside the case even knew it existed. Buried in the document was a line that read simply, ID cards inside glove inside box. No names, no dramatic labels. But according to several major news outlets, one of those IDs belonged to someone who either lived at or was associated with the King Roadhouse in Moscow, Idaho. The house where the four college students were brutally murdered. The ID discovery was largely glossed over on the public narrative at that moment in time. The headline had already crowned the knife sheath as the smoking gun against Brian Koberger. The media attention had moved on to the cell tower pings, the DNA from the trash. But this ID, if confirmed to be tied to a victim or a resident of that house, that could be one of the clearest, most haunting physical connections between Koberger and the victims. And yet, for some reason, it got pushed aside. Like a crucial puzzle piece that was too uncomfortable to stare at for too long. Now, it's important to clarify, the authorities have never officially confirmed who the ID belonged to, okay? So we're covering that right now. I'm not going to sit down here and go, it is one of the people in the house. I know there's been speculation. One of our own contributors has said it many times on the air, especially back when it happened. And many major reputable news outlets have reported that it allegedly belonged to one of the victims. We'll wait for law enforcement and for that information to come out in the actual trial, or if it comes out earlier in one of these unsealings. Due to the gag order, that information is still under tight lock. But the placement of it in a glove, in a box, in his parents' home, feels kind of intentional. It's not something you just toss aside and forget about. It's stored, hidden, preserved. And in cases like this, when a killer keeps something that belonged to the victim, even indirectly, it starts to look like a psychological marker. What investigators sometimes refer to as a trophy. Not in a celebrity sense, but in the deeply unsettling serial offender kind of way. You know, magical. A piece of the crime that the perpetrator just couldn't let go of. There's a lot of serial killers in history who have done this, who have kept the IDs of their victims. It's a sick thing. And something that's led to a lot of their downfalls as well. And that's just the beginning. There are many other pieces of evidence here that we're about to be talking about. Also taken from Koberger's family home was a pair of black shoes from Marshalls. At first glance, nothing really remarkable about that prospect at all. Buried in the probable cause affidavit, investigators noted that a shoe print was found outside the sliding glass door at the back of the King Road home, left behind in blood. It was described as a diamond pattern sole, consistent with what you'd see in a Vans style sneaker. Again, we don't have lab confirmation of a match between Koberger's shoes and the print at the scene. But the connection is sitting there in plain sight. A pair of shoes. A known tread pattern. A bloody footprint. But the media? Surprisingly silent on that one. You think someone might want to know if the shoes match the print, right? But again, a lot of that has remained under seal. Even more quietly collected, a Walmart receipt. One of those long, curling paper trails of impulse and planning. It was recovered with other belongings that could be nothing or everything. What is it going to show? It's going to show the purchase of the gloves or the cleaning products or clothing that matches the description of what the suspect was seen wearing. These aren't hypotheticals tossed into the air. Law enforcement specifically requested access to Koberger's Amazon and PayPal accounts as part of their search for purchase history tied to the crime. That Walmart receipt is just a physical breadcrumb in what could be a much larger transactional trail. And yet, since it's mentioned in the evidence, it's kind of vanished from public conversation. So we're bringing it up here. A throwaway item that might reveal a whole timeline, as we've now seen other receipts have certainly done. One of the most quietly personal items seized That'd be a handwritten note to Dad. We don't know what it says. The authorities haven't released it. We don't even know the tone. Was it heartfelt, apologetic, chilling? Just a reminder that, hey, let's go to Subway on the way back to Pennsylvania? Could be anything. All we know is that it was logged in the inventory of evidence, which means someone in law enforcement thought it could be relevant to the case. What we can say with some confidence is that when investigators are looking into possible motive, state of mind, or intent, a personal note becomes an artifact worth reading if it holds even a whisper of acknowledgement or emotion tied to the timeline of the murders. It could be enormously important. And again, silence on this one. Not even a hint of curiosity from a lot of outlets. Everybody's stuck on the knife sheath. And, you know, rightfully so. Those are solid, solid pieces. These are a little more speculative. They could potentially go either way. I am completely admitting that. The fact that some of these things are searched out for in evidence before they even get to there is another sign that they have some idea that maybe these things, or likely these things, are involved in some way, shape, or form in this case. Time will tell, though. There's another matter, the flashlight, easy to overlook because, well, everyone has one, right? But if you're breaking into a house with no lights in the dead of night where four people are sleeping, you're bringing a flashlight. If that flashlight has blood or fiber or prints in the wrong place, that could be another piece of the trail. And if it was listed in the search warrant return right alongside more obvious suspicious items like gloves and electronics, but didn't get the kind of attention it deserved, maybe it didn't seem sexy enough for primetime coverage. Maybe it was just too easy to ignore. Then we come to the Night Rile gloves. These show up in multiple places, in Koberger's car, in his apartment, in the trash. He was even reportedly wearing gloves when agents surveilled him in Pennsylvania before the arrest. Now, it's possible he was just being cautious. COVID was still kind of a thing at this point in time. We're on the tail end, or one could argue we were out of it. But there were still people masking up and gloving up somewhere, especially in December of 2022. But wearing gloves in your own home, in your parents' house, after a quadruple homicide? A little weird. Hard not to raise an eyebrow to that one. Gives off the impression of someone who's aware of touch DNA, who maybe wrote a paper on touch DNA and all of that, of how to evade being caught after committing a crime like this. Who's thinking about forensic traceability, the kind of awareness that doesn't typically belong to someone with nothing to hide. Again, all conjecture. And finally, there were the shoeboxes and empty packaging. These weren't just cardboard clutter. Investigators were likely looking for signs of what had been recently bought, worn, used, and maybe, just maybe, disposed of after the crime. You don't bring gloves, a weapon, or specific clothing to a crime scene without thinking about what you're going to do with it afterwards. At least, you would think the killer wouldn't do that. If the box remains, but the contents are missing, it's kind of a red flag. It's like finding a holster, but no gun, or a knife sheath with no knife. A tag, but no jacket. The wrapping, but no gift. What ties all of them together is that they were hidden in plain sight, sitting in closets, drawers, trash bins, boxes. And they didn't scream their importance. And they likely wouldn't in many cases. They didn't come with a narrative ready to sell to headlines. But they do matter. These pieces of the puzzle that might never be fully solved in the public eye, but each one adds depth to the picture investigators are building in this case. And yet after the initial flood of headlines and the warrants being unsealed, most of these items still faded into the background. The ID cards had their moment, the gloves were briefly discussed, but the shoes, the flashlight, the Walmart receipt, almost nothing. It's as if the story became too focused on a single piece of evidence, the knife sheath. And everything else kind of got shoved to the evidence closet, waiting for its day in court, which a lot of it still does. That's why this case has become a story about a mountain of forgotten details, physical clues that once seemed to matter but now live in the footnotes. We don't know how each item fits into the prosecution's theory. We don't know which ones will be presented to the jury or how the defense plans to challenge them. But we do know this. These items didn't get collected by accident. They were seized because they were pointing to something. Planning, perception, control, maybe even obsession. Or maybe just bought and looked at as being potential items, but, you know, dismissed. While the physical objects tell one side of the story, the tactical material world, they're just the surface, what we haven't seen and what we might, what actually might prove to be even more revealing is what is going on behind the scenes. The trail he left not in boxes or receipts, but in keystrokes, in data. What he searched, watched, clicked, and stored. And that's where we're going next. Because when the headlines started flying in the early days of the Koberger case, almost all of them clung to one detail like it was the holy grail of the forensic evidence. Of course, the knife sheath. And to be fair, it was a big deal. A U.S. Marine Corps K-bar knife sheath found under one of the victims with DNA on the snap. It is the kind of moment CSI investigators recognize as being a big one. But while the sheath did steal the spotlight, a whole separate trail of forensic work was quietly unfolding behind the scenes, mostly ignored, rarely talked about, and possibly just as important in building the case. I'd start with something subtle, something that doesn't always scream murder weapon, but it has quietly closed the door on many investigations. Hair. During searches of Koberger's apartment and car, investigators found multiple strands of human hair and what was listed in court filings as possible animal hair. It didn't take long for a lot of people to draw the possible connection because one of the victims, Kaylee Gonzalez, had a dog named Murphy. Murphy was left alive inside the King Road home, found unharmed in Kaylee's room. Now, if Koberger had been in that house and that dog had any physical contact with him, it's not outlandish to imagine that some of the dog's hair might have ended up on Koberger's clothing. And from there, into his apartment, into his vehicle, onto anything he touched before he changed clothes or tried to clean up. It's a kind of trace evidence that often doesn't hit headlines because it isn't instant. Hair analysis, it takes some time. Especially when it involves mitochondrial DNA or matching animal hair to a specific source. But in court, even a single verified strand in the wrong place can speak volumes. And right now, we don't know if that possible animal hair has been conclusively linked to Murphy, the dog. Prosecutors haven't confirmed it, and the gag order keeps that kind of information under wraps. But the fact that it was collected and noted in official documents tells us they saw it as potentially relevant. Same goes for the human hairs. The search warrants mention multiple strands being collected, though there's no detail on length, root presence, or any match to the victims as of yet. What we do know is that these weren't pulled from the crime scene. They were pulled from Koberger's environment, which opens up the possibility that someone's hair traveled with him after the crime. Got stuck in the clothing, maybe clung to his car seats, maybe it lodged itself in carpet fibers or laundry. Maybe it's just random hair that he picked up walking around Walmart or something. Again, nothing conclusive has been shared with the public yet, but the silence doesn't mean irrelevance. It usually just means the lab is still working and the trial has not yet started. And then there's the mattress covers. Remember these? During the search of Koberger's Pennsylvania home, law enforcement seized mattress covers and pillows. They didn't just bag them up and move on. They tested them for blood. This isn't typical unless you believe there's a real chance that the suspect brought something, some residue, some transfer evidence back to the bedding. When you pair that with the other items taken, like cuttings from a reddish-brown stained mattress cover, It becomes clear that investigators weren't just checking boxes. They were looking for proof of contamination. Blood is notoriously difficult to eliminate entirely. Even a faint smear invisible to the eye can react under luminol and yield positive results on tests. And if the blood doesn't belong to the suspect, even more reason to investigate further. Even if it is blood, we don't even know if it is blood. The assumption is, based on the stain and what they saw. Again, still out there, still in the ether. These are some of those things that we have not heard about because of the seal. Expect more of this to start dropping soon. We don't have confirmation that the blood was from any of the victims or even that the stains, again, were definitely blood. But the fact that cuttings were taken and processed tells us the samples were suspicious enough to analyze further. Then investigators looked at it and went, that looks like blood. We do this for a living. We see this on a normal basis. In murder investigations, they often rely on this kind of indirect evidence, traces of blood where it shouldn't be, appearing at times in places that defy innocent explanation. Now let's talk about vacuum dirt, which, yes, sounds less thrilling than a bloody weapon, but is actually a gold mine of trace materials. Investigators vacuumed Koberger's apartment and collected debris from the floor. This isn't done to find a needle in a haystack by accident. They're looking for micro-evidence, slivers of hair, carpet fibers, dust embedded within skin cells, even particles of soil or plant matter. It's the kind of material that can be processed in layers and then broken down and cataloged to build a forensic narrative. Imagine finding a victim's hair fragment or a specific fiber that matches a victim's bedding, embedded in the dirt of the suspect's vacuum. Doesn't need to be dramatic. It just needs to be real. That's the power of trace forensics. They don't shout, they whisper. But that whisper is the truth. One of the most quietly pivotal pieces of the entire forensic puzzle, though, came in the form of a pile of trash. Specifically, a bag taken from outside the Koberger family home in Pennsylvania. Inside that trash was DNA from his father. And that DNA was used to link back to the DNA found on the knife sheath, everyone's favorite piece. And of course, that's not accidental. It was a strategic move by law enforcement to build a familial DNA profile when they didn't yet have a court-ordered cheek swab from the suspect himself. And that connection between father and son, between trash and murder scene, was strong enough to justify the arrest. This technique is often called genetic triangulation. It became a standard part of modern investigative playbooks now, but it's rarely appreciated for how decisive it can be. They didn't find Koberger's DNA in the trash. They found his father's. And it was close enough, statistically and genetically, so strong to support the case that Brian Koberger's DNA was the one on the sheath. In the court of public opinion, that detail tends to get overshadowed by the end result. But in the court of law, how you get there does matter. It wasn't guesswork. It was methodical, scientific, and it was precise. Also seized were stained cuttings from other parts of the home. Some may have come from fabric, others from bedding. The documents don't exactly say, and the stains themselves haven't been officially described. They're labeled as reddish or brownish and marked for lab analysis. So we're still in the dark on their origin. It could be, you know, spilled charcoal berry fin Kool-Aid. Or it could be the blood of one of the victims. The very existence of multiple stained samples being carefully prevented and tested, or preserved and tested, rather, shows just how thorough this forensic process has been. Authorities are working backwards from the possibility that something came back with Koberger from the scene and embedded itself in the most mundane parts of his everyday life. Then there's the matter of the shoes. Simple detail that's been almost completely forgotten in the public story. When investigators examined the King Road house, they documented a partial shoe print near the back sliding glass door. Again, described as the diamond pattern. Again, does not prove guilt. But it does suggest that whoever left the print might have worn a Vans-style shoe or something with a similar sole design. And what was one of the items seized from Koberger's home? A pair of black shoes. The brand has not been publicly confirmed yet. It's safe to assume they're being evaluated for sole pattern and wear. Shoe print comparison isn't just about matching treads. It's about pressure points, gait patterns, and the depth of imprint. If the shoe from Koberger's house can be matched physically or statistically to the print at the scene, that could be another thread tying him to the house, physically and directly. But here's the thing. None of this evidence makes big headlines. None of it has cinematic punch of the DNA on the knife. It's all slow. It's all quiet. It's meticulous. It's the work that doesn't get a camera pointed at it. But together, it does build a case, one where the physical aftermath of the crime can also echo into every corner of a suspect's life, into his car, his bed, his trash, his vacuum. These are the threads that don't break easily. They're the ones that stretch across states, through carpet fibers and hair follicles, across time zones and forensic backlogs. While they may not be the centerpiece of every media report, they might end up being the foundation of this case itself once everything is unsealed and we are in that courtroom. Of course, as compelling as these physical and trace clues are, they're still only part of the story because in the background, something else has been quietly compelling. Logs, files, data trails, the kinds of digital footprints that don't rely on fingerprints or footprints at all. Not what he wore or carried, but what he searched, what he bought, what he watched, what he planned. And that trail, that's going to be an interesting one, as we're about to go down that right now. And there's a lot in it. When police searched Koberger's Pullman, Washington apartment, they walked out with some pretty ordinary-looking items. A computer tower, a flash drive, nothing flashy, pardon the pun. Nothing, again, suspicious on the surface. But if you spent any time looking into how modern investigations unfold, you know that those pieces of hardware could end up being, again, very revealing pieces of evidence in this case. Think about what you store on your own computer. Now apply that to someone accused of planning and executing a quadruple homicide. A hard drive can carry everything from search histories and downloaded documents, GPS data, maps, cached forums, encrypted logs. If investigators were able to imagine or image that drive and recover deleted material, which, by the way, they almost always can, you're looking at the potential for detailed digital footprints that map out not just what happened, but why. So far, there has been no public disclosure of what was actually recovered from the computer or the flash drive. That's not unusual. Investigators often sit on that kind of evidence until it's needed for court. But the fact that it hasn't leaked, hasn't surfaced in filings, hasn't even been teased in press conferences, adds weight to the silence. Because either there's something too sensitive to release, or there's something they're not ready to show their hands on yet. Or there's nothing at all. Alongside the computer hardware, investigators also went after Koberger's Amazon and PayPal accounts. Again, that's not snooping into someone's shopping habits. It's looking for purchases that align with the crime. And, well, they found some stuff. A knife, perhaps, maybe gloves, possibly dark clothing, or even something as seemingly innocent as cleaning supplies. The gloves, in bulk, think bleach, think a knife holster, think of flashlights. Those are the kinds of digital breadcrumbs that don't just support a timeline. They can show intent. As of now, haven't seen all those receipts, but we certainly have seen some. And there's a knife and a sheath and a sharpener and the same type of mask he was reported wearing on some of those receipts. We know that much. While he exactly hasn't been confirmed exactly what he was watching, you know, on television, on Netflix, On his computer, police also seized a Fire Stick device from Koberger's apartment. Most of us use it to stream Netflix, catch up on the news, maybe fall down a few YouTube rabbit holes. But those viewing histories can be forensically extracted. Was he watching coverage of the murders before or after the crime? Was he researching other cases? Was he looking into how forensic evidence works, how police track suspects, or even studying court procedures? Or was he watching people he admired? People that he thought, I can relate to these guys. I made this point in another video. The button-up shirt, super tight, with the thumbs up. Looks a lot like the character in American Psycho. Standing in front of a shower. Psycho, the actual movie. And let's take Koberger himself. Is he all that far off from the Norman Bates-type character? I don't know. Little conjecture there. But the fact that there seems to be two indirect references in that photo that he took of himself in the shower directly to a movie, two movies with the name Psycho in them, and Ted Bundy with a thumbs up. I know it seems a little questionable. A little more like he's smarter than everybody else in the room and he wants you all to know it. Until you do, and then you discover, well, he's not the smartest person in the room. So what is on the Amazon Fire Stick? We don't know yet. But those are the kinds of answers investigators tend to look for when they seize your TV stick. Now zoom out, because this next part doesn't come from a hard drive or a smart TV. It came from the airwaves, cell tower data. According to the probable cause affidavit, Koberger's cell phone was tracked to the vicinity of the King Road house at least 12 times before the night of the murders. Think about that. That's not a wrong turn. That's not a coincidence. That's a pattern. It's a loop. A set of deliberate paths that show his phone traveling near the victim's residence again and again. Does he have a viable excuse for that? Is that a road he would normally travel for some sort of reasonable reason? We don't know that yet. Most of those visits, according to the affidavit, happened late at night or early in the morning, making it a little more creepy and a little less like a routine drive. And then there's the most unsettling part of that data trail. On the night of the murders, his phone went dark, turned off, disabled, or put into airplane mode. Whatever the method, the effect was the same. From 2:47 a.m. until around 4:48 a.m., the phone left no trace. That blackout window happens to overlap almost perfectly with the estimated time of the murders. Nothing to see here. Here's the thing. Turning off your phone, of course, does not prove guilt, but when you stack it on top of prior movements, the repeated presence near the crime scene and the forensic evidence from earlier chapters, it becomes harder to brush off. It paints a picture of someone who knew what kind of digital evidence could come back to haunt them, tried to avoid leaving it behind. Still, a phone is only one part of the network. Investigators also pulled records from license plate readers and surveillance cameras, including footage showing a white Hyundai Elantra, Koberger's car, driving past the King Road house multiple times in the early morning hours of November 13th. According to the affidavit, it looped through the neighborhood several times before eventually leaving town just after 4:20 a.m. The same cameras picked up that Elantra making the return trip westbound towards Pullman a few hours later. The timing is sharp. The vehicle ID is supported by visual confirmation. And the route, as laid out in court filings, matches the digital trail from Koberger's cell phone both before and after it went dark. But that one piece of the puzzle still hasn't been fully explored in public. His online activity. The affidavit does not mention Reddit or YouTube or Facebook. course, if you dig into the digital warrants that have been filed in the weeks after his arrest, it's clear that investigators were interested in those platforms. They were looking for any signs that Koberger had interacted with content related to the case, or worse, with the victims themselves. That could mean comment threads under new articles. That could mean posts in crime forums. That could mean YouTube search terms or viewed videos about the murders. And then there's a quiet questions no one has officially addressed yet. Was Brian Koberger posting anonymously online about the murders? There's been plenty of speculation about certain Reddit accounts or Facebook users who claim to have inside knowledge and presented inside knowledge. None of it confirmed. But it's not hard to imagine why investigators would at least explore the possibility in high-profile cases. It's not uncommon for suspects to monitor coverage or even insert themselves into the narrative under the cloak of anonymity to try and control the narrative. Which we did happen to see here. The character named Papa Roger. Remember that? If you're watching us on YouTube, you can see. If you're listening, I'm showing an image right now of Papa Roger and Brian Koberger side by side. It's striking how similar these two individuals look. One is an artistic rendition of what looks to be a general of some sort. But the profile of the individual, the facial layout, it is strikingly similar. And this profile was out there before anyone had named Brian Koberger as a suspect. Commenting on the case, giving specific information nobody else knew about the knife sheath, about details of the crime, and telling everyone it's a red herring when they started asking about the Hyundai Elantra. The odds of somebody making this fake profile of Papa Rogers, putting it up online and talking about things that no one else knows. And it just happens to look pretty much like Koberger with a military style hat on. Little weird, little suspicious. It's another thing that they are certainly taking a very close look at, and I'm sure more things that we will find more out about in the coming months or once trial begin. And while we've seen flashes of it, the cell phone data, the license plate tracking, the shopping records under subpoena, what we haven't seen might be even more important. There could be maps bookmarked on his browser, a journal on his desktop, cached pages of the King Road house pulled from real estate listings, or maybe just Google searches. Harmless, you know, until you line them up with the timeline, until they say something like, how long does DNA last on fabric, or how to clean blood from car seats? Again, that's pure speculation. But those are the kinds of digital trails that tell a story. But they don't tell everything. They don't show up in body cam footage or dramatic courtroom exhibits. They live quietly in metadata and downloaded logs waiting to be brought to light. And maybe that's why the digital evidence feels so elusive, but so powerful if it's there. Because unlike the physical clues, the digital ones don't just suggest that something happened. They can show how he thought about it, get into his mind, what he prepared for, what he feared, what he didn't know. And if any of that shows up on his computer, on his Fire Stick, or buried in his online accounts, then the story we think we know about this case could shift dramatically. For although now, for most of it, it is sitting and it is under seal. Part of a sealed investigation, part of a trial yet to be held. But one thing's clear. The digital dust is finally blown off those devices and those records come to light. We may not just get more proof of what happened. We may get a closer look at who Brian Koberger really was and why this happened in the first place. What are your thoughts on all of those items? Let me know in the comments section. Would love to hear your feedback. And be sure to press subscribe wherever you're downloading podcasts, or if you're watching us on YouTube, press subscribe, hit the bell button so you don't miss any of our updates on this case. We have a playlist specifically for this, and we also have a podcast channel specifically for it as well. So please do check all that out. Hit subscribe. And yes, we do want to hear from you in the comments. It's a lot to unpack here. More stuff is dropping every single week. We'll see where this goes. We will see where this goes. Let's hear your voices in those comments. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for joining us.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Forget everything you had planned for this weekend because you are sitting on your couch and winning from the comfort of your own home. I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play hundreds of slot games, all of the table games you love, and you could even win real cash prizes. New users, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Extra Value Meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For a limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Forget everything you had planned for this weekend because you are sitting on your couch and winning from the comfort of your own home. I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play hundreds of slot games, all of the table games you love, and you could even win real cash prizes. New users, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
SpinQuest Social Casino. The presents are open and you're over the in-laws. It's a perfect time to grab your phone and play SpinQuest.com with live dealer blackjack, craps, and a ton of slots. And here's a great deal for the holiday, a $30 coin pack for $10. And if you're hearing this ad, you can play right now on SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. and there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love, with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com, SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
SpinQuest Social Casino. The presents are open and you're over the in-laws. It's a perfect time to grab your phone and play SpinQuest.com with live dealer blackjack, craps, and a ton of slots. And here's a great deal for the holiday, a $30 coin pack for $10. And if you're hearing this ad, you can play right now on SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love, with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com, SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right.